Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Catherine Corbett of Lighthouse Books in Brighton. Each week, we visit with an author, editor, publisher, or bookseller from our region. We hope to find out a little about their lives, what they love about their job. We give them an opportunity to read from their work, or the work of those they would like to promote. We're very pleased to have Catherine Corbett with us today to talk about special books that she's found popular with her customers. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Catherine Corbett is a former elementary school teacher and librarian. Her career working with books and kids and as an avid reader herself gave her the interest and qualifications to take over Brighton's well-known Lighthouse Books when the previous owners retired. She and her husband Dan bought the business a couple of years ago and are enjoying the challenges of running an independent bookstore in what many have found difficult times. Well, Catherine, did you always dream about owning a bookshop, or was your actual purchase of Lighthouse Books a surprise to you?
I would have to say it was a surprise. Although I have always been a book lover, I can't say that it was a dream to own a bookstore. I read widely and spread that enjoyment to the time that I had with children in the school library. But I did also visit Lighthouse Books as a customer. I would go in and chat with the owner and shop there for myself and for our school library since we moved to Brighton in 2006. But I was in one day and had been vaguely aware that the owners at the time had been looking to sell the business, having run it for about 20 years, I believe. I overheard one of the owners saying to someone on the phone that she was now quite serious, and if the business didn't sell very soon, they would simply sell off the stock and close up shop. So at that point, I let that sit with me. I went home to my husband and said, "It sounds like they're quite serious about closing things up, and I feel very sad about that. Our bookshop would be missed on Main Street." And my husband said, "Yes, that does sound sad." And then I said, "Yes, but it should be us. We are the ones who will keep it open."
And he said.
And he, having come from a retail background and retired and enjoying his retirement, I think he thought it was a bit of a crazy plan, particularly when I said to him that I felt that if we could keep the bookstore running and have it pay for itself, then it would be a retirement project for us. We had both done quite a bit of volunteering in the community since we were both retired. I had retired from being a teacher librarian a couple of years before. So I said to him, "You know, we have been volunteering our time. If we can just make this bookstore pay for itself, then that would be something we would do in the community." So his response, after being trained in his background and business and retailing, was, "That's quite a business plan." But he did go along with me, and there we are.
Yes, indeed. So we hear so often these days that no one runs a bookstore unless they love it. So what are the things you love best about it, and is there a downside?
I think the thing that I love best about it is something that I have loved from way back when I was going to university. I worked at W.H. Smith, which was a bookseller in the Toronto area, and I went to the University of Toronto. At that time, when I was there, I enjoyed so much connecting with customers and saying, "You might like this book." Mm-hmm. Then when I went on to be a teacher librarian, I had that same positive experience with the children, where I'd think about a child and the things that they enjoyed and liked and their level of reading, and would make a suggestion to them. And one of the most rewarding things for me would be to be, as teachers do, wandering around the yard on yard duty and see a child come running across the yard at full speed to tell me something. But it wasn't a tattletale on a friend or anything. It was to say that the book we talked about had been read last night and very much enjoyed. And it was a really rewarding thing.
Yes,
and
a
now
real
in the
reward.
And now in the bookstore, I have that same experience where I get to know the customers and think, this is a book this person would really enjoy. Mm-hmm. Matching readers and books is a very rewarding thing for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you asked me, Felicity, about the downside. I suppose one of the downsides is something that's common with retailing or many, many things that we get involved in, and that could be the relentlessness of it.
Yes. It.
That once we have committed to have the store, then customers rightly can expect that it will be open.
And
yes, it will be open enough days of the week to make it convenient for them. And of course, that means we need to be there. So mm-hmm. that would be a downside that many people experience in their positions.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. So tell us some more about running a bookstore in 2018. What are the biggest challenges? You have some help in the store with this relentlessness.
That's true. That part is alleviated somewhat by having some very competent and wonderful women who work part-time in the store along with us. My husband, of course, does lots of things behind the scenes. So, yes, there is that challenge that we have met. I suppose the largest challenge is, I think I would call it, the perception of the availability of things that are online or in the big box stores, and that is a competition and a presence that's always there for us to consider.
Yes, and it's a problem, really, isn't it, that some people just publish an e-book now. You can't very well sell that in the store.
That's right. That's right. Now, I would say on a positive side of things that I feel that there has been some bounce back, and that in some ways the most damage that e-books, if you could call it damage, I mean, I'm a person who occasionally will read a book on a device, an electronic device as well, or read some, obviously do lots of reading online. But I feel that people now have experienced some of the novelty of that and some of the practicality of it. For instance, if you're traveling and you can carry a number of books with you on your e-reader, that may mm-hmm. be more convenient mm-hmm. than taking a stack, as I used to do. But people have experienced that and then realize that in many situations they would prefer to go back to a book in print. So mm-hmm. for instance, if my e-reader is sitting on the coffee table at home beside a real book in print, I will never pick up the e-reader. I want the feel of that paper book. The e-reader is a convenience for me, and I feel like people have come through that in a way and now are hybrid readers where they would have both things available to them, and then we're there to fill that need.
Right. You don't have enormous space at Lighthouse Books, so how do you decide what to stock? Do you make an effort to find out what's going to appeal to your customers in advance?
Most definitely we do, but something that I'm smiling about when you ask me that question is the space. And of course, I love reading for all ages and all genres, but in particular, I have a soft spot for the children's books because of my background, I suppose, and I'm a parent and a grandparent. And so if you come into our store now and you see the children's section, the way we find the space is we simply tuck more and more things in behind more and more things. But still, space is an issue for us, of course, and there is quite an availability of different books that we could stock in the store. So indeed, I do check with our customers to see what they might like and watch and see the upcoming releases. I refer to the information that publishers send. I use book lists and book reviews from various sources. But largely, I do listen to what the customers are asking for. And also, I listen to the wider readers that are my friends and family and the things that they enjoy, the authors that they know about.
It is a challenge.
It is, yes.
So how about reading to us from one of your favorite books, or one that you think, you know, that is a favorite of your customers?
Well, I would say one that I have now with me today that's of interest to people. It's a nonfiction book called Whiskey King by Trevor Cole. Trevor Cole might be known to many people as a novelist who has been nominated for a couple of Governor General Awards. He's won the Stephen Leacock Award for Humor. Mm-hmm. Recently, he came out with a nonfiction book that describes the life of a bootlegger, which I think has a particular interest to people in our area because that is part of our local history. This particular bootlegger's name is Rocco Perry, and he's the man who's mentioned in the title Whiskey King. The book also follows his nemesis, we could say, an RCMP officer, and it is in the early days of when the RCMP started to use undercover work in order, of course, to track some of these various characters down. So the book is very interesting in following both Rocco Perry, the bootlegger, and Frank Zaneth, the man who chased him. I think what I'm going to read to you today is excerpts from near the beginning of the book, because I would hope that people's interest would be piqued and they might come and want to read more about it and delve further in.
What was the date of this, of Rocco's life?
It's starting in, well, this, the action in this book starts in 1923, but he came from Italy at the end of the 1800s, this particular man, and the book goes on over the decades as well. So it indicates that as we get started. It was 1923. Prohibition had shut down the legal trade in liquor across most of Canada and the United States, but the whiskey still flowed, and the pipeline was made of boats. Rocco Perry, at 35 years old, was the most powerful bootlegger in Ontario at the time, and he had built up a makeshift fleet of as many as 50 vessels, schooners, cabin boats, and pleasure craft, that plied Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. Most of the men in these boats weren't criminals. As a rule, Rocco employed men without records, and he insisted they carry no weapons. It meant less trouble and less scrutiny from the police. Many of the skippers were simply fishermen trying to scrape up enough money, especially during the cold months of fall and winter. The risks were small. Few men would dare hijack a Perry boat, and undermanned police forces rarely caught any rum runner in the act, and they seemed that those risks were insignificant against the chance of making hundreds of dollars on every run. Now, skipping ahead to just a little bit, from Toronto, the boat called the Hattie C made its way east along the lake's northern shore towards Prince Edward County. In the hole below, the four men had food for a week, at least two cases of empty bottles, and between the bunks, a heap of more than 100 strong burlap bags. Bags were lighter and less bulky than wooden crates. They allowed rum runners to haul larger cargoes. Each bag would hold up to 24 bottles of whiskey, and in a pinch, the men could dump that load over the gunwale, and it would disappear. On Monday, October 1st, the humble schooner chugged around the headland of Prince Edward County and into the zigzagging waterway of the Bay of Quinte. A little while later, John Gogo pulled the craft up to a concrete government dock where a boxcar of whiskey sat waiting for them. And here is where the tricky work of rum running began. Liquor laws in the Prohibition era shifted like pieces on a game board. Since 1916, Ontario's lawmakers had constantly had to adapt regulations to adjust to the political and societal forces pushing for and against the buying and drinking of alcohol. By 1923, the year that this John Gogo was running liquor for the Perry Organization, it was against the law to buy or transport alcohol within the province. But it was perfectly legal for Ontario distilleries to export their product to another country, even if, as in the case of the United States, that country had imposed prohibition. Government officials, known as outside customs inspectors, were stationed at docks and warehouses to ensure that the product from Ontario's breweries and distilleries, being loaded aboard boats and trucks, was indeed headed out of the province. And they required proof, specifically a B-13 shipping form, filled out with the details of the boat, its cargo, and that cargo's buyer and destination. But those customs men could be bought off.
Thank you, Catherine. Now we'll take a short break.